Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction and free shipping. And that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Welcome to Jerusalem Unplugged, the only podcast dedicated to Jerusalem, its history, and its people. Your host, Roberto Mazza, will bring you guests discussing their relationship with the Holy City, a journey through history, society, feelings, and hopes for the future. Follow the podcast on all social media platforms at Jerusalem Unplugged.
Welcome to Jerusalem Unplugged, the podcast. I'm your host, Roberto Mazza, and today my guest is Chad Lay. Chad is an assistant professor of Spanish, early modern and medieval Spanish cultural studies at the University of Denver. I just want to mention that his work is at the intersections of religion, politics, gender, and race. And I want to mention one publication that we're going to talk about. Together with Ken Tolley, they published the book Jerusalem Afflicted, Quaresmius, Spain, and the Idea of a 17th Century Crusade. We're also going to talk about an upcoming project, and I think this is like one of the most interesting aspects of the podcast, which is about possessing Jerusalem, the Holy City, and the invention of Spain. Chad, welcome.
Thank you.
Chad, the first question I always ask my guest is, what is your Jerusalem? In other words, what is your connection with the city?
I began my dissertation at Brown University a while back, and it was a study of the place of Jerusalem in early modern Spanish cultural production, in literature and in the political arena. And so my first connection to Jerusalem was through books, through texts, through early modern, particularly late medieval and early modern texts. So I read a lot. I read epic poetry, travelogues, books of pilgrimage, devotional treatises, maps, all sorts of visual representations of the city. But I would say that city is a very really artificial city in a lot of ways. It's a very removed from my own experience city. And I had people for years ask me how I was working on Jerusalem without going to Jerusalem, having never been there. How was I going to write about the city? And I think it's a good question, and I think it's something to think about. So a couple of years ago, I got a several grants and was able to travel to Jerusalem. And I was there really as a researcher. I was there to spend most of my time in the archives of the Franciscan custody of the Holy Land. That's there in the Old City, and also the libraries of the custody. And so I was there as a researcher, and I spent pretty much all archives. I rented an Airbnb maybe 20 minutes, half an hour outside of the old city. And I walked into the city every day and spent my time in studying and working. And then whenever I wasn't in the archives, I was walking around the old city, mostly all the quarters of the old city. And I have to say, I've still not entirely figured out my feelings about the experience, because I really, really wanted to have an emotional connection to the city. Having read so much about it and also reading about other people's responses, I just assumed that I would also have sort of a really visceral connection in that way or something. But I think I struggled while I was there with this tension between being a participant in the ritual and in the life of being in that place and being an observer. You know, I felt a lot of the time like I was more like an ethnographer or an anthropologist, observing and thinking about things and less feeling myself in it. I think it's a beautiful, very, very complicated place. And having only spent a few weeks there, I don't think I have enough time there yet to really say that I know what my Jerusalem is. I think that it's a slippery place for me, in that I left not entirely understanding it, and I think I'm gonna have to go back again to get a better grasp on where I stand in Jerusalem.
Well, understanding contemporary Jerusalem is certainly a very hard job for not just scholars, but even for people living there. But I'm curious about something. You're an expert of 17th century. When you were around Jerusalem, did you see anything that was still connected to the period that you studied, your knowledge about the city that you acquired through the text that you read? Did you see any hint, anything that was left of that early modern period?
So one of the things that I was really hoping to be able to see, and I was able to see, was the custody in Jerusalem has a very sizable collection of objects of cult that have been donated from European donors over the centuries. Largely royal donors, but referring to altar cloths, chalices, all sorts of monstrances, all sorts of objects that were used in religious practice and religious services and in ritual by the Franciscans. And those objects, I think, are very important because they are part of a very complicated economy of exchange between Catholic Europeans and the Franciscan custody. And there's a very interesting political and economic dimension to that maybe we'll get to talk about. But to your question, when I was there, I was very graciously helped by some folks working in the custody who allowed me to see a number of artifacts, objects that are still housed there. And these have also been on display. There was a beautiful catalog published a few years ago on the Treasure of the Holy Sepulchre. I think there's an English and a French version of it. An exhibit that went to Paris, I believe. But I got to see some of the objects that came from Spain, and specifically from 17th century Spain. And there are quite a number of things that are housed there still that harken back to that period, that are from these exchanges of material things between Spain and the Holy Land in the 16th and 17th centuries. The most memorable one, a couple actually. I went they invited me to a mass that was being said in the rotunda right under the in the Holy Sepulchre. The altar, the front of the altar, for that mass, they adorned it with a very, very large like a bas-relief silver silver piece that covered the front of the altar, which was from the period of Philip IV, and who reigned in Spain in the early to mid 17th century. And they also showed me after a different mass that I attended, absolutely gargantuan object, which was a gold, I don't remember now exactly what it was. I'm only remembering what it looks like. I don't know if it was a monstrance. It might have been a monstrance, but it was a huge, huge piece. It stood many feet tall, all made of gold and silver, engraved with the name of Philip IV, this same monarch that I'm mentioning, also encrusted with gems and jewels and things. And just a really tremendously ostentatious piece of royal performance of devotion to the holy places, sent from the King of Spain to the Franciscans. That's just one piece, but also some vestments and some other things that were from that same period. So I'd say that those artifacts really stuck with me because they're so striking, the rich material culture from that period, that not only is it there, you know, as museum pieces, but the friars that are there continue to use those pieces, some of them anyway, in their ceremonies up to the present day, which I think is really interesting, that they get brought out for special occasions. So that was probably my own personal response to that question is those artifacts really, really stuck out. They're very, very impressive, and they're part of this huge exchange of things sent from Spain, from other places, from Italy, from all over, to the Franciscans in the Holy Sepulchre in particular.
Yeah, I just want to mention to the listeners that the custody of the Holy Land is a Catholic run by Franciscan institution. In fact, probably one of the oldest religious institutions in the city. And essentially it works like an international corporation because by statute, the various roles are basically appointed according to nationality. So the custos, which would be sort of the leader, is Italian, or must be Italian, in fact. And then a number of other roles are covered by Spanish and then by the French, English, Americans, and so forth. So every nationality has essentially a place in the ruling of the custody of the Holy Land. And their job is essentially to protect the holy places in the broader Holy Land, which includes what nowadays is Israel, Palestine, Lebanon, parts of Syria, and even Cyprus. This is a fascinating institution, and the treasure preserved in the archives and in, I would call it, the vaults, are just inimaginable. I did work several times there, and I could only scratch the surface of the material, that they have. And I think one of the most important aspects of the custody is that essentially ever since the 13th, 14th century, they have records, they have material of, their work in the city and in the region. So it's an amazing source. Having said that, I wanted to ask you something about Jerusalem in the 17th century. I must admit, I don't know much other than obviously Ottomans took over from the Mamluks. But other than that, and the question of the walls and obviously redesigning and pouring some money the economy of a city, but I must admit that I don't know much. And in fact, I feel like there is an historiographical gap. So I was wondering, through your readings, how was Jerusalem more century?
I have to preface this answer by saying that my own understanding of that question is definitely biased by the sources that I'm familiar with. So I work with Spanish Catholic sources primarily, sometimes Italian sources, things in Latin, but that leaves a huge gap in my understanding of the period, because I'm not working in Arabic and I'm not really working with Ottoman sources. Although I can read, I can read a translated collection of firmans or something, and get a sense of things. The sources that I most work with are these Spanish sources. So, having said that, so if you read those sources, and I'm referring to both of the archive at the custody as well as the Archivo Histórico Nacional in Madrid, they have a whole section of documents that are part of the Obra Pia de los Santos Lugares, which hopefully we can talk about later on, which is a sort of dependent agency within the Spanish Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And what I would say generally about all these sources is the picture that you get from the city, from the Catholic Spanish perspective in the period, is that place, because it was under Ottoman control. There were Ottoman authorities who, and this is, I think, still the case, that, you know, technically control the keys to the sepulcher. But there were, in lots of different ways, movements in and out of sanctuaries and through the city were constrained by Ottoman authorities who, according to these sources, often describe them as there's lots of extortion and bribery and money that need to be paid for fines, for infractions, for just entering and leaving places. So it's a huge money suck that's constant. And there's also a very tense relationship between Franciscans and other Christian communities in the Holy Sepulchre. In particular, the Greek Orthodox community is represented as absolute incarnations of evil. They're always out to plot against the Franciscans, to take away territory, to undermine their efforts. Similarly applied to the Jewish community of the Jews conspiring with the Greek, them out of certain places. So the feeling that these is that the Franciscans are in great need of help, that they're in a great dire situation, that they're being abused physically, they're being hauled off to prison or beaten for things, they're being extorted. There's an account in one letter, one of these letters I mentioned, where a lower level Ottoman official comes to the sepulchre, demands wine from the friars, who can't not give it to him because they don't. And then when they do give it to him, are then punished because they gave wine to him. So that kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't, caught between a rock and a hard place rhetoric is a really, really core element of so many accounts of the city. Spanish Franciscan 17th century perspective, it's a city that's marked mostly by tension between this community and other groups in the city, and like I said, physical violence and anxieties around money are super constant in these texts.
Looking at sources just a few centuries later, you find the same leitmotif, essentially Franciscans complaining about the Ottoman authorities. And obviously you have plenty of examples about physical violence between Christian denominations. And certainly I personally collected material about incidents either in Jerusalem or in Bethlehem between the two. Those included casualties. People died, essentially.
That's absolutely, and that concords with my own experiences too. One really, this is to tie this thread we're following now with what we talked about earlier about the beautiful collection of in the Holy Sepulchre. Philip III, who reigned from 1598 until 1621. I think 1621. My Hispanist colleagues will murder me if I get wrong the death of Philip III. But anyway, Philip III sent to the Franciscans an absolutely gargantuan silver, pure silver lamp that was sent to the sepulcher to hang in front of the tomb. And by all accounts, there's multiple archival accountings of this object, and it was massive, and it's described as the envy of other communities and the greatest thing that was ever received as a gift. At the end of the century, I don't know if it was right at the end of the 1700s or right at the beginning of the 1800s, there was a large conflict between the different Christian communities and the Holy Sepulchre that was described more or less as a riot in contemporary sources, with, you know, friars beating each other up and people getting thrown around. And in the context of that violence, where people got hurt and, you know, damage was done inside of the sepulchre, this huge silver lamp was like thrown on the ground and destroyed and broken into multiple pieces. So they ended up sending it back to Spain, had it remelted and recast into some candelabras that were then resent back to the sepulcher. And those are still actually in the church there and in the custody. But yeah, it's just an example of like an all out just a battle between people in the Holy Sepulcher, and those kinds of things are not uncommon in the sources that I work with.
Well, and at a lower degree, those battles are still there. I mean, there's been a change of pace and a change in the language, but you know, we're still there in many ways. I want to ask you
something.
I think so. European had an interest in Jerusalem for different reasons, in different ways. Titles, you know, the throne of a king of Jerusalem, or properties or protections over the various Christian communities. When we think about 21st century, it's hard to think about Spain and Jerusalem. So what was the relationship between Spain and Jerusalem back then? How come Spain was so interested in Jerusalem?
That's a phenomenal question. The answer is maybe a little long, but I'll try to give a good answer. And this narrative that I'm about to tell you, I is a narrative that is in the 21st century official state discourse. It's a part of how Spanish official accounts of the Spanish royal past continue to memorialize and remember the connection, an intimate connection between Spain and Jerusalem that dates back many, many, many centuries. And so that history you can find, for example, in the Boletín Oficial de Estado, which is the official state bulletin in Spain where official acts of the government are published. I mentioned earlier the pious work of the holy places, the Obra Pía de los Santos Lugares, is an organism that still exists. It's been sort of secularized and neutered in a little bit of a way, but it's still there as an official piece of the government. And in both official state bulletin, you know, for example, when they have to, you know, renew the annual budget, for example, and there's something that alludes to the Obra Pía, you encounter this rehearsing of the narrative that Spain has had over the course of many, many centuries, a very, very intimate, very close, and very meaningful connection between the Spanish crown and Jerusalem as a city, as a place, as a sacred place, and in particular also between Spanish crown and the Franciscan custody. So those connections that you see in these sources, that up to even the 21st century, they really harken back to the 14th century, during the period when the Aragonese crown was invested heavily in the 15th century, in particular, expanding into the Mediterranean. And I say the 14th century because in the 14th century, Mallorca, who were the monarchs in Naples, they were also the titular, Robert of Anjou was the king of Jerusalem as well, through a complicated series of claims, and, you know, there are no shortage of claims to the throne of Jerusalem in the period, but Robert of Anjou in Naples claimed the throne of Jerusalem. And not only that, but Robert and Sancha also negotiated with the Mamluk Sultan for the purchase of the material properties that would become the foundation for the Franciscan custody. So Robert of Anjou and Sancha of Mallorca, the custody wouldn't necessarily have the form that it has because they donations or those initial, you know, material places. And there are a couple of papal bulls that recognize this, like Gratias Agimus is probably the most instant. If you go, you know, even if you go to the website of the custody, it's still sort of, there's a history that that references that, right? So where Aragon comes into this is that Aragon in the 15th century, in particular, 14th century, 15th century, was a maritime dynasty expanding very forcefully into the Mediterranean and conquering territories and sort of spreading their commercial and maritime empire across to the east. And as part of that, they eventually acquired Naples, the Kingdom of Naples. And when they did that, a lot of the same claims to Jerusalem that had been part of the Neapolitan crown, such as the claim to the throne of Jerusalem and also this foundational claim of having established the Franciscan custody itself, those claims were absorbed by the Aragonese crown. Aragon sort of appropriated those as part of a royal patrimony that then became part of Aragon's patrimony. And when the Catholic monarchs Ferdinand and Isabel were married and united the crowns of Aragon and Castile, and you know, this is a sort of complicated thing, but you know, modern Spain has its origins around that period, and there's different ways we can account for that or think about it. And even talking about Spain in the singular in this period is a little bit problematic, but I'll just say that Spain, under Ferdinand and Isabel, also under Ferdinand and Isabel, these same claims to a super intimate connection to possession of the Holy City as monarch of Jerusalem and also protector and patron and foundational sort of establisher of the Franciscan custody, both of those Neapolitan claims became part of Spanish patrimony. And in the context of the Italian wars of the 15th, 16th century, which were kind of a big messy business involving especially Spain and France, there were a lot of competing claims over this. But in 1510, the investiture of the title of King of Jerusalem was formalized by I forgot which pope right now, but that's irrelevant. But the pope invested the Spanish crown with this title of, you know, king of Naples, king of the two Sicilies, and also king of Jerusalem as part of that sort of package. And from that period forth, that was in 1510, we can see that for example, in the Spanish Constitution of 1978, which was ratified after the death of Franco and part of the transition to democracy in Spain, that the historical titles that the crown possesses are still allowed to be used. And so in that way, in an official sort of legislative sense, even the King of Spain today, Philip VI, is officially, in from a Spanish perspective, the King of Jerusalem. That's one of his official titles. But I also mentioned something that's really important, which is the Obra Pia and this claim to this foundational connection to the Franciscan custody. And on that side, what is really, really undeniable, you mentioned earlier that the custody has a sort of division of labor between different nationalities, that, you know, the French or Italian or Spanish positions that were rotating were always fulfilled by people from those places, right? The Spanish job in the custody was basically to operate as the sort of money person, the person who ran accounts. And in that sense, that foundational connection to the economics of the custody created from early on, from a very, very interesting connection where the Spanish crown saw itself as the principal supporter, the principal financer of the activities of the custody. They really viewed themselves in those terms, as without the Spanish material support of just raw money, as well as material objects such as, you know, wax, wine, grain, without those material supports sent from Spain to the custody would simply not be able to operate. And so I recently published an article about one document where we see this narrative. But in that document, an argument made that if Spain were to stop supporting the custody in the way that it has historically, and this is a document from 1604 to 1605, that's when it's from.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Without the Spanish support, the custody would cease to exist. That the custody exists only because Spain continues to pay for the custody's activities. And while there might be some support that comes from Rome, and there might be some alms that come from Genoese or Venetian or French or other people, Spain is the one that really, really pays for the majority of the things. And to be truthful, if you look at the financial records of the period in the 17th century, that does seem to be the case, that most of the money that flowed into the custody, a very significant proportion of that money came from Spain. That function of the Spanish state, it became not just part of the monarchy, but it became part of the sort of bureaucracy of a modern state. And this happened under a king named Charles III. And there's an interesting document where he decrees that this alms providing this support of the custody is something that is central to this, to the operation of the government, and that it's going to be, you know, taken over by, you know, the bureaucracy, basically. And so into the, you know, the 18th, 19th centuries, by the 19th century, we get what, you know, what would then become the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Spain, and is now the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Cooperation. And that thing that, that was these charitable, devotional donations and material support over the course of centuries, became, institutionalized as the Obra Pia de los Santos Lugares, the pious work of the holy places. That's the name of that organization inside of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And the Obra Pia has continued to operate in what up into the present. The Obra Pia has evolved in its mission, and in the present day, it's viewed as more sort of a group that, a place to house diplomatic activity between Spain and the Holy Land, in a sense. But and it's really sort of lost its, some of its more explicit framing as part of Catholic devotional practice. There's an article that came out a couple years ago outlining the kind of progressive secularization of the Obra Pia, because, you know, it's called the pious work of the holy places, so it's hard to secularize something with a name like that. But that's it has become a fixed element of the Spanish state up into the present. And so on those terms, just on the sort of, in terms of diplomacy and in terms of economics and in terms of material connections, and also in terms of what from the Spanish side is a legal argument that the Pope recognized and invested the King of Spain with this title. And so now it's an official part of the Spanish crown. For all of these reasons, Spanish sources over the course of centuries insist on a really, really special and important connection between Spain and the Holy Land. Spain, the King of Spain literally is the King of Jerusalem. He literally possesses the material places that are the Holy City. And the Ottoman or Mamluk or whatever presence there, I suppose later British and whatever, that those are less so in the present with the modern state of Israel, but that rightfully Spain owns Jerusalem. And the fact that the Ottomans are in Palestine is just an accident of history or of divine retribution or of whatever things. But the fact that they're there and not the King of Spain is an aberration. It's a problem, and it's an anomaly. And as sort of aside from that, this whole material part as well, that's the progressive institutionalization of these connections has really guaranteed that has also remained a really important part of how Spanish sources view this long, long history. So like I said sort of at the beginning of this long little speech here, this whole account that I just gave you in a two or three paragraph form, you can still find it rehearsed before official state documents that mention the Obra Pia. They mention this whole history. They say, you know, from since the 14th century, when Robert of Anjou and Sanchez Mallorca founded the custody and that became part of Aragon, our monarchs have been those who have kept the custody going. And had claims to the throne of Jerusalem for centuries. And so even in the 21st century, you can still find that narrative.
I want to interrupt you here, because one thing that I remember, was that like a few years ago, there was still a debate in Italy. Obviously, we no longer have a monarch in Italy, but when the monarchs were readmitted after decades, you know, they've been kicked out after World War II, one of the titles that they claimed was to be the King of Jerusalem. And I remember that all, you know, triggered all of these debates about who's the, you know, who's the real King of Jerusalem, whether it's the Spanish monarch or, you know, the claims goes to the Italians because they had it from before. And I said, okay, it was just fascinating that there were all of these claims about a throne that does no longer exist. But I suppose, particularly in Spain, and that was my experience working with Spanish material, and particularly because of the presence of the Obra Pia that you mentioned, there is still a deep connection, which I found extremely interesting.
Oh, no, I was saying, yeah, absolutely. And I think that even through the 19th, 20th, up to the present, 20th centuries, there has been a Spanish cohort of friars that are continue to carry the banner of a sort of national pride over all these connections. They're very proud of these connections and very proud of the things that have, in a sense, entre comillas, belonged to Spain. Buildings and sanctuaries that were founded by or paid for by this lot of national pride among the Franciscans in Jerusalem over the course of, you know, many, I want to say even generations, but decades. There's been a Spanish cohort in the Holy City that's kept that flame going.
We are going to take a short break. Thank you for listening. And remember to join our Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram account. If you have a story about Jerusalem that you want to share, or someone that you want me to interview, please get in touch. Enjoy the rest of the show. This is a unique form of colonialism, honestly, because it's not about possession of land, of control of land, but it's more about some sort of image, sort of belonging to a place and connecting the city with the history of a country. I have two more questions, and very much about your work, the one that you are working on, and maybe a short sort of a question about the previous work. In your current work, you're talking about possessing Jerusalem, and essentially you're already talking about this idea of the Holy City and connected to Spain, but you also use this very powerful word, the invention of Spain. So my question is, how does Jerusalem actually contribute to the invention of Spain? How does this relationship work?
I think that's like you said, it is a very complicated and in a sense strange form of colonialism because of the fact that there might be a territorial claim built into this, but it's there's an intangible element as well, the sort of symbolic capital of possessing the most sacred site in human history, in the most sacred material location on the planet. Having a connection to that, and in a sense is an interesting form of control and an exercise of power. I think that the way to answer your question is that it's a complicated question, right? But I would say that the primary way that the Holy City serves to imagine what is Spanish essence, what is the nature of Spain, who are Spaniards, what is Spanishness, has to do with a claim to a particular sort of holiness, a particular sort of specialness of a kind of notion of chosen people, maybe. There's definitely a big supersessionist logic in this, that Spain is in the 16th and 17th century, that Spaniards are the new Israelites, the new chosen people. That's not a unique phenomenon to Spain. You know, everybody wants to be the new chosen people and the new Israelites, and that's a very mobile idea as well. But it was a very potent one in Spain. So I think that in lots of ways the discourses and practices, which are material, you know, as we've seen, in political and legal and diplomatic and economic, and also that take place very, very much in the realm of cultural production and in literature and in the world of ideas and in visual material, you know, representations of the city. This whole vast array, there's like a sea of materials that in all sorts of different ways are constantly sort of crying out that Spain owns Jerusalem. So what those what all these materials are doing in all these different genres is in different ways creating an entire sort of cultural and political and social matrix where the idea that Spain has a special connection to Jerusalem becomes a very, very important part of the world, the way that things are in 16th and 17th century Spain. This is the same period when Spain was engaged in all sorts of processes of imagining a religious and also ethnic racial purity for itself that is really, really essential. So as you'll recall, Spain, the Jews of Iberia, Sephardic Jews, were expelled from Spanish realms in 1492. The Nasrid Ara, the last Muslim dynasty in the Iberian Peninsula, was also conquered by Ferdinand and Isabel in 1492. And in the subsequent years, not too long after that, all of the descendants of the Muslims who were living in Spain were forcibly converted to Catholicism. And this follows the massive conversions of Jews from 1391 onwards in these mass conversions, coupled with the colonial project in the Indies, where conversion was also really, really important, they all coalesce to create a society which was also heavily policed, right, through the organization of the institution, a society that was very fixated on forms of imagining purity, forms of imagining purity in terms of religious practice of orthodoxy, but also forms of purity in terms of blood, in a sort of biological, genetic, racialized sense of identity. There was a sense that you had to be pure of blood. Limpieza de sangre blood cleanliness was a not just a discourse or an idea, but it was actually like a bureaucratic procedure as well. You had to demonstrate through documents that you had no ancestors who were in order to have access to certain official charges, official posts, to do certain things, to enter into certain groups or societies. So that sort of obsessive fixation on notions of purity, whether religious or racial, ethnic, in terms of blood, is really, really draws strength, I argue, also from Spanish connections to Jerusalem. It's not just that Spain is looking for a sort of homogeneous, Visigothic, Roman, Catholic, pure populace as the people that are these new chosen people. It's also that those chosen people that are these pure people also happen to be the same people who literally own Jerusalem, who literally have claims to the place wherein the redemption of humanity was wrought by the death and resurrection and those kinds of ideas. And so that that connection to the Holy City, I think, is a really, really potent driver of these ideas. And it's not just in the context of an autochthonous project where deriving inspiration from its own claims to the Holy City, but it's also a tool for international relations as well. And I think this is very interesting. It's not just that Spain's people internally are being cast as special or pure. It's also that Spain relationally on an international scale is also using Jerusalem to position itself. Jerusalem is a tool through which Spain positioned itself on a geopolitical level, both in its relationship to the Ottomans, which is kind of obvious in the Eastern Mediterranean, and to Maghrebi polities all across, North Africa, with which Spain had constant, conflict, and there were explicit crusading in the early 16th century, explicitly cast as crusade efforts to take places, conquer places in North Africa, and that's a really, really important part of the colonial project as well. But not just the Muslim other, let's say, of Spain, but also a way of mediating or relating to Christian polities as well, and especially with France, because France has such an intimate connection to Crusade and to the Holy City. There was a lot of rivalry that was worked out through claims to Jerusalem in this period. So claiming Jerusalem, saying you own Jerusalem, saying that you are specially connected to Jerusalem is also a way of saying that of controlling and of casting how your relationship is to the Ottomans, how your relationship is to the French or to the Venetians or the Genoese or to other people. And in all these ways, it's a really, really potent trope to say, you know, Spain owns Jerusalem. It's a way of asserting ethno-racial religious purity within Spain. And it's also a way of saying that Spain is superior. So Spain, I see argument on a global level as well, that Spain is like the best of all Catholic nations because nobody else has Jerusalem. And Spain is destined also to conquer the Ottomans and to place, you know, a new Catholic presence in the Holy City. And that kind of narrative, we see in different sources, it feels like a very early 16th century narrative, if you know Spanish stuff. The kind of, especially the prophetic stuff, or, you know, around the time of Columbus, for example, there's a great book by Alain Milou about his relationship to these discourses of prophecy and the possession of Jerusalem. But it really lasts far, 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 far longer than you would expect. And when I first began this work, I really thought, okay, this is maybe the reign of, you know, Ferdinand and Isabel, Charles V, maybe Philip II. Maybe if we're lucky, it can get a little Philip III up until, you know, early 1600s. But no, these kinds of ideas continue through the reigns of, and then you'd think, okay, well, this is a Habsburg thing. But shortly after the War of Succession and the Peace of Utrecht and all that at the beginning of the 18th century, there continue to be this insistence on these narratives. There's a really interesting history written by a friar, but I want to say 1712 or somewhere in there. I'm not really exactly sure of the year now, but in which he rehearses all these same things, and he reminds the monarch, listen, you're the king of Spain, your ancestors, people whose throne you now inhabit, are those who have kept the custody going. And that sort of argument continues, as I said, through the, you know, Charles III in the 18th century, and you continue to see it in sources up until the 20th century, when there's a massive, I think, recalibrating of this and reappropriating of it, obviously for the national Catholic discourses of Francoism, the you know, General Franco's dictatorship of the 20th century, really, really loved the idea of crusade, of the national Catholic project as a crusade. And not only that, but in the, you know, in the 1950s, for example, in 1954, 55, Franco oversaw an exhibit of the Holy Land that took place in Madrid in the Parque del Buen Retiro in downtown Madrid. Where they transported literally thousands of artifacts, of archaeological remains. They had water brought from literally from the River Jordan. They had literal sheep transported from the countryside in Bethlehem to Madrid that were on this topic. They also had a number of physical recreations. There was a life-sized model, for example, of the edicule, the structure of the tomb that's inside of the rotunda, inside of the Holy Sepulchre, the life-size, basically making a new Jerusalem literally in Madrid. And that thing lasted for over a year, that exhibit. But as part of that exhibit, there was also a hall of, one of the halls in the exhibit dedicated to memorializing the particular connection between the Spanish monarchy and all of this, that Spain, in a sense, this exhibit casts Franco as the inheritor of that same legacy. And, you know, Franco only died in the 70s. And so since the 70s, there's been maybe some sort of uncomfortable either ignoring or not reckoning with this legacy. But I have to say that the resurgent far right movement, in particular the Volksparty that is really sort of frightening right now in Spain, they're very much also invested in these narratives of Spanish purity, a sort of ethno-racial Catholic purity that rejects immigrants, that rejects Islam, that rejects Judaism. That's an area that I need to work a little bit more in, but I'm very certain that in certain contexts that the connection between Spain's relationship with Jerusalem and the present in Spain is something that they're aware of and that they derive, you know, pleasure from and a sense of power from, really, a sense of entitlement and a sense of supremacy over other people who don't have that special connection.
For the past maybe three decades or so, there's been an attempt by historians to give back agency to the inhabitants of Jerusalem, even looking back at earlier history in order to include Jerusalemites. But I think now we just arrived to a point that we forget that, and we forgot in a sense that actually Jerusalem is still part of many different cultures and, you know, around the world, that these countries have appropriated Jerusalem in different ways. And sometimes I just realized when you were talking about it that, I mean, we need also to add the element in order to understand the city itself, because there is a real Jerusalem where people live, have their daily businesses, but there's also this projected Jerusalem. And it's something that defines the ways in which we understand the city and we understand also, you know, those countries. You can't really understand Jerusalem without it. And I guess you can't really understand, in this case, Spain without understanding Jerusalem. And I think this is like not just fascinating, but very important. I have one last question, and I want to go back to your first work that you published with Professor Cantoli. So I know that you work together, and I'm only asking you out of curiosity a brief description of this very interesting individual, Quaresmius. My understanding is that he was born in Italy, in Lodi, not far away from actually where I grew up, but I must admit I never heard of him, of course. And my understanding is Spanish crown, and essentially he called for a crusade in the 17th century. Who was he? Why calling it for a crusade? What was his goal?
Yeah, he is a really fascinating character. I mentioned him earlier. He's best known for this two volume work that is a history of the holy places, and it's printed in folio, two columns. It's all in Latin. It's a very, very difficult work that very few people have studied. In 1626, Quaresmius was at the time living in Jerusalem. He lived in Jerusalem on a number of occasions. He also traveled widely throughout Syria and Egypt and other places. He was on a papal mission at one point for to strengthen ties with the Chaldeans and Maronites, and so he had a number of different roles that connected him to the custody and to Christianity in the East. But in 1626, he delivered this sermon to Philip IV, who is the monarch I've mentioned a few times. And this sermon was printed in Milan in 1631. And it has never been, since 1631, as far as I can tell, no one has really read this work very much. I don't know of any scholars up until the present day, aside from Marianne, who I just mentioned, who has ever cited it directly. I've found allusions to its existence as a title in bibliographies or at a footnote saying, for example, here's an example of crusading in the 17th century, but without any sort of engagement with it. So I, with the help of a dear friend, Paola Plastich, who's doing her PhD right now at Davis, and also with some funding, I ended up going to the Ambrosiana in Milan, which is where this text is housed in a unique copy. At the time I went there, we thought it was the only one in the world. It turns out there's one in Buenos Aires as well, which I also got my hands on. But this very, very unique document is an account of, it's a plea from Quaresmius to the King of Spain, begging him to conquer the Holy City. And in that plea, he invokes many of these same narratives that I've been mentioning. So he frames Philip as the King of Spain and as the patron and protector of holy places through his connections to the custody. He also mentions in the context of the sermon that Philip is the Grand Master of the Order of the Knights of the Holy Sepulchre, which was something that is a little bit debatable because there was a move in the 17th century to name Philip II as the Grand Master of that order, and that wasn't ratified in Rome. But that doesn't mean that the crown didn't like to assert that they were Grand Masters of the Order of Knights of the Holy Sepulchre anyway. So in 1626, this very long, it's a 74-page sermon, lays out the case that the king of liberate Jerusalem from Ottoman tyranny. And it's cast in the voice of personified Jerusalem. She's a woman who's pleading for her own liberation. And she casts Philip as the person that can save her in that way. It's a complicated text and lots of things I really won't get into here, but I would say that what's interesting about this case is that it's not entirely unique. There's also from the previous monarch, Philip III, there's a letter from an Italian Franciscan writing in Italian to the King of Spain in 1603, I believe, also calling on the King of Spain to take up the cross and conquer the holy places. These authors I mentioned, both of whom are Italian, are very convinced in their texts that for important strategic reasons as well, the King of Spain is the person who can do this because he has a large armada and a powerful army, and he's asserted a sort of global dominance in territories around the world, and that the moment is ripe for him to embrace his destiny as the titular king of Jerusalem and actually lay claim to that crown, to that throne, by conquering Jerusalem.
Esto era el profesor Chatley. Gracias. Or if I need a translation, this was Professor Chatley. Thank you very much for being with us at Jerusalem Unplugged.
Thank you so very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Jerusalem Unplugged. This podcast is currently commercial free. There are no ads. The only possibility to stay this way is for you to please let your friends, your family, and others who may be interested in listening to Jerusalem Unplugged know about this podcast. Let's increase the audience and let's keep the podcast commercial free. Thank you for listening. Until the next one.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.